Okay, we are holding on Lamed Aleph, Lamed Aleph. We're holding on Lamed Aleph, two lines from the top.
Lamed Aleph, two lines from the top.
We learned yesterday about stolen Dalad Minim, about the pros and cons of that, so now the Gemara is going to go off on a tangent for a bit for the first half of the summer and talk about what about a stolen sukkah? I meant to mention yesterday, by the way, an interesting remez that the Rekeach brings on the fact that the Dalad Minim we said are not allowed to be stolen. He says there's four psukim in Kapitel Kuf Yud Tes that have four words each. Most of the psukim in that kapitel have five, six, seven words. There's four psukim in that kapitel that have four words each, representing the Dalad Minim. And each of them, we know, you know, the famous thing that each of the Dalad Minim represents a different kind of Jew, the one who learns Torah and does mitzvahs, the one who does one, who does the other, who has neither. Each of those four psukim refers to one of those kinds of people. One of them is, I speak of your mitzvahs, and I look at your ways, so that's the Esther, the one who does both Torah and mitzvahs. There's, I enjoy your mitzvahs, which I love. That's the hottest person who focuses on mitzvahs.
Wait, this is 119?
In 119, yeah. And then there's similar psukim in under Samach and under Kuf. Samach one refers to somebody who learns Torah, say Afim Senesi Vesarasa Havdi, and the one from Kuf is Krasicha Hoshieni Veshmer Aidasapha. Right now I'm not doing either. I'm not learning Torah and I'm not doing mitzvahs, but Hashem gave me and I will do them. That's the Arava. If you look at the letters, the Rekeach says, if you look at the letters that make up these psukim, there's an aleph someplace in them, there's a beis, etc. There's no gimel, no zayin, and no lamed in any of those four psukim, representing the idea that there can't be gezel involved with the dalad minim. Mm-hmm. Anyway. So, Tana Rabbanan, we learn in a braisa, the sukkah gzula, a stolen sukkah, v'hamasakech v'rishus harabim, or somebody who puts up a sukkah in rishus harabim, where they are effectively stealing from the public, because the public is supposed to be able to walk over there, and he's not allowing it. Rabbi Eliezer posts up a chamim achshir, and Rabbi Eliezer says it's possible, the chachamim say it's okay. So, Amar Rav Nachman, machloikus b'shtokev es chavera v'atiyah misukasei. The machloikus between Rabbi Eliezer and the chachamim is specifically if you have a person threw somebody out of his own sukkah. So Reuven builds a sukkah on his own property. Shimon goes and throws him out of the sukkah and starts sitting there instead. That's where we're saying is the machlokes, where Rabbi Eliezer says it's possible and the Chacham says it's kosher. Why? Rabbi Eliezer is going according to his own logic. D'Amar, he said in the previous perek, Ein Adam Yotzei Yedei Chevasa B'Sukkasa Shachaveri. He says in general you can't be Yotzei with somebody else's sukkah. So that we said last time he says that you can't even borrow somebody's sukkah. You have to use your own sukkah throughout the 7 days of sukkahs. So therefore, we can look at it as follows. There's actually, we mentioned yesterday the concept, the Gemara just took it as a given yesterday, that kauka ain't an exelus, that land cannot be considered to be stolen in halacha. The truth is, it's not so simple. There's actually a machloikas about that at the end of Bava Kamma. We talked about yesterday why it is that kauka can't be an exel. And we were mentioning yesterday, because practically speaking, there's not going to be Yerush on it, because it's always there. That's not necessarily, actually, what the Gemara discusses over there is a different issue. Where do we know the concept that you have to return something you stole? Because the pasuk is Veheshev Eshezela. So the Gemara explains it, that there's Machloikas Tanoim, there's something over there which can be understood as a klal or prat or klal, or it can be understood as a ribuy or miur to a ribuy. If we say it's klal or prat or klal, then it means that land is excluded. It's only movable items. On the other hand, if we say it's ribui or miut or ribui, then it includes pretty much everything. The only thing that's excluded is shtarit, which they themselves, the shtar itself, isn't worth anything except as a piece of paper. The value of it is the debt or whatever that's written in it.
What's the law of the ribui miut?
Ribui would be when the Torah says that the Torah has an inclusive expression, then an exclusive one that says one specific kind of thing, and another inclusive one. In general, there's a number of places in Shas where the Tanoim argue when we have such things, we darshan it as a ribui miut ribui, which means, therefore, that it includes pretty much everything. There's only going to be one thing that's excluded. Or is it a klal or prat or klal, which then it means that anything that's in that only includes things that are similar in some way to the prat, but not everything. So there, the Gemara discusses the issue that therefore this is negeya as far as whether land can be considered to be stolen, whether, in other words, whether the gazlan acquires title to the land and has to return it, or whether he never acquires title to it in the first place. Which the Mishnah talks over there about a case, for example. Imagine that Reuven has a field. Shimon goes and steals it from him. He throws Reuven out and occupies this land. Now what happens if the land afterwards becomes damaged? There's a flood, for example. If you take the view that Shimon the gazlan actually acquired the land. Well then, in that case, then it was his when that happened. He's now responsible to reimburse Reuven for that damage. As opposed to if you say that he was not koine it, that he never acquired title to it in the first place, effectively it's been Reuven's all along. When it got flooded, then Shimon has nothing to do with it being flooded. He has to return the land eventually, but we don't care about the fact that before it was fertile and now it's flooded.
Yesterday we said Karka and Nami together.
Right.
We bring both into this union of Yush.
So now we're saying it's not necessarily a matter of Yush or not. It's not necessarily a matter of Yush or not. It's a matter of does the gazlan even acquire title to that? Does he make a kinyan on that karka at all?
Okay, but here we talked about a chazaka. You need 3 years of chazaka, and there's an amecha and all these things.
That's in Bava Basra, actually.
True,
but that's when you buy land that you have to have chazaka on it. Gazlan, even if he's squatting on land for 3 years, the general rule is you need chazaka has to have kol chazaka she'eni matayna in a chazaka. If Reuven comes one day and he sees Shimon squatting on his land and he says, "Nu, what are you doing over here?" and Shimon says, "What are you talking about? I've been here for 3 years. Why did you buy it from me or something?" "No, but I found this abandoned property and I figured nobody's bothering with it, so I took it over." That's called she'eni matayna. That chazaka doesn't count. So the same thing, if Shimon is a gazlan, and we say kauka ain't an exelus, that you can't acquire title to kauka just by stealing it, and his chazaka is not going to do him any good either.
When you have a chazaka,
means you bought it, or got it as a gift, or whatever.
You
usually, that's the idea. The reason why chazaka is for 3 years is because a person will keep his shtar up to 3 years. Yeah, but obviously, if he stole it, there's no shtar yet. Anyway. So actually, in the Gemara there, in Bava Kamma, Rabbi Eliezer is the one who says that karka that can be nigzel, that the gazlan can acquire title to karka, not like we said yesterday. But here the Gemara is
not the same.
Yesterday we said Rav Huna. Here we're talking according to Rabbi Eliezer. But here, what the Gemara is going to actually do over here is point out either way. Whether you go according to Rabbi Eliezer's actual shitta, where he holds the karka can be nigzal, that the gazlan acquires title to the karka, or even if you were to say that he doesn't, either way he would say because of his shitta in Hilchos Sukkah that the sukkah is possible because you stole it. Why? E karka nigzalas, if karka can
the sukkah
that Reuven built and Shimon threw him out of the sukkah and took it over.
Right.
So that's what I'm saying. If karka can be stolen, if Shimon acquires that karka by virtue of having stolen it once there's yirsh, well then in that case then sukkah gzulahi, then it's an outright stolen sukkah, and everybody agrees that it's stolen.
On the land.
No, that's what we're talking about. That's what we're talking about. The inami karka in an exelus, and even if you were to say, like we said yesterday, that karka cannot be stolen, that it still stays in the chazaka of Reuven all the time, you have a different problem. Sukkah shulahi, it would be the equivalent of a borrowed sukkah. And Rabbi Eliezer said you can't use a borrowed sukkah either. So either way, Rabbi Eliezer would say it's no good.
Because he
says, right, he said l'cha meant that it has to be your actual sukkah. So therefore, either way, either it's considered stolen or it's considered borrowed. Either way, you're no good. Yeah. V'rabbanan l'taymai, whereas the Rabbanan go according to their logic, they say that a person can be yotze with somebody else's sukkah. Wait, 1 second. So they're saying, but karka ain't an exelus. So they're saying, they hold that karka cannot be considered to be stolen, like we said yesterday. Yeah, like Rav Huna said yesterday. And therefore, the sukkah she'ulahi, therefore it's the equivalent of a borrowed sukkah. Because what you're saying is, this land never belongs to Shimon in the first place. It always stays Reuven's land. Therefore, the sukkah that's built on that land also, effectively, is still considered Reuven's sukkah. So all Shimon is doing is he's borrowing. Okay, it's not really borrowing because it's against Reuven's will, but still, what would we say would be considered a stolen sukkah? Like we said yesterday, a stolen lulav is, for example, that Shimon grabs a lulav from Reuven and uses it for the mitzvah. He's actually kind of that lulav when he's actually able to be kind of that lulav. But then we say he can't because it's
this.
Yes, or just Shinui Hashem, or Shinui Maisa, or whatever the various possibilities we talked about yesterday. But here there's nothing. Here there's nothing by which he does a kinyan on it. So therefore, there's on the land or on the sukkah, which is attached to the land. So therefore, it's not considered. So therefore, it's not gezula. It's not a stolen thing because by definition, it's not stolen. It still belongs to Reuven. So therefore, effectively, it's considered a borrowed sukkah. So Rashi points out, I mean, the Chachamim did agree, in the previous Perek, when they were talking about how the Chachamim versus Rabbi Eliezer darshan in the Pesukim, we said, Rabbi Eliezer says, L'cha means you can't use a borrowed sukkah, and the Chachamim said it means you can, you just can't use a stolen sukkah. According to this, what's a stolen sukkah, according to the Chachamim? If they say kauka in an exelus, then what's considered a stolen sukkah? So Rashi brings up the possibility, how about you have, for example, as we learned in the previous Perek a week ago, if you have a sukkah, for example, on top of a wagon, a mobile sukkah, that's not attached to the ground. So therefore, yes, it is possible for the Goslin to make a kinyan on that. Because not...
The sukkah itself that you took from somebody.
No, we're not talking about you picked up the sukkah. We're talking about the you. No, it's a 1 second, because we're going to talk about in a second what happens if you steal wood and make a sukkah out of it. We'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
Right now, we're still dealing with the case where the sukkah is, you actually stole the land itself. When would the Chachamim agree it's considered a stolen sukkah, says Rashi, if the sukkah is not attached to the land at all? If it's on a wagon, for example, or around the back of a camel, or all the different cases that we had in the previous parak. Tosfos says you don't even need to say that. Tosfos talks about a possibility, an interesting possibility. What would happen, Tosfos says, suppose that Reuven goes into Shimon's property and he builds a sukkah over there. And then Shimon goes and throws him out of the sukkah.
They both
So 1 second.
Reuven is using Shimon's land, and Shimon is using Reuven's sukkah.
Okay, so actually, I mean, Tosfos says the words midaita, but I go to Bachchan changes it to Shaloi midaita, that it was against, that it was without Shimon's knowledge. But the issue then you have is like this: the land doesn't belong to Reuven because, again, by definition, it belongs to Shimon; it's Shimon's property. On the other hand, when Shimon goes and throws Reuven out of the sukkah and takes it over and sits in it, he is. Right, so now you can't say that because he didn't steal the land, therefore the sukkah is kosher.
Right.
In a way, he kind of did steal the land because the land never belonged to Reuven in the first place. So therefore, that would be a case that you're talking about, that would be considered a case that you're talking about that even the Chachamim would agree is a stolen sukkah. So in Shulchan Aruch, it brings both of those possibilities, either that you're talking about a sukkah on a wagon, for example, or you're talking about a case like that. And actually, it comes out in Shulchan Aruch the other way around, that if you did give Reuven permission to build the sukkah over there, and then you threw him out of it, then you would be allowed to sit in that sukkah. Because then, Reuven, since you gave permission to Reuven to use that spot, it's now considered his space for the sukkahs. And therefore, again, ain't karka negzelus. When you go throw him out of it, you haven't reacquired that karka. You're effectively borrowing it from Reuven. You're not allowed. You're not supposed to. But if you did, then yes. So it's kind of backwards. The logic is kind of backwards over there. If you didn't give him permission, and he built the sukkah there, and then you threw him out, then you can't sit in it. It's a sukkah gzula. But if you did give him permission, and then you threw him out, then you are allowed to. Having said all of that, though, it does say in Shulchan Aruch that even in all these cases, we talked yesterday about Lulav HaGozel, we're talking now about Sukkah HaGozel, even in cases where technically you'd be allowed to use it, you're not supposed to make a bracha on it. Because that would be Ein Zemavarach El Menai. So let's say a Berach Niyet Hashem, the robber steals something and then he makes a bracha on it, that's blaspheming Hashem, like the Pasuk says in Dillon.
Yeah,
So he can be yotz of the mitzvah, but he shouldn't make a bracha on it because that wouldn't be praising Hashem. That would be denigrating Hashem.
He shouldn't even make a bracha.
Yeah.
Wow. So
yeah. If he steals money, that's a different matter because if he buys food with the money, then he's not returning. He doesn't have to return the actual. I mean, he has to return the value of it. He doesn't have to return the original thing anymore.
Right.
Because there was shinui rishus.
Yeah.
But that's not so simple. But yeah, we did talk about yesterday the case. For example, Tosfos mentioned the case where a person buys wheat and grinds it up into flour and makes bread out of it, and then wants to take challah from it. But then Taka, you shouldn't make a bracha on challah for that. Yeah. Anyway, So that machlokas. So again, this machlokas where Rabbi Eliezer says that a sukkah, that a stolen sukkah is possible, and the Chachamim say it's kosher, would have to be in this kind of case where you're talking about the karka. And the issue is that Rabbi Eliezer holds that either way, Rabbi Eliezer himself holds that karka can be stolen, that it does now belong to the gavlon. But on the other hand, then it's a sukkah gzula, and then it's a mitzvah ba'avera. And on the other hand, if you were to say, even if you were to say that he holds that karka cannot be nigzul, which is not how he holds, then it's still considered a sukkah sh'ola. Whereas the Chachamim say a sukkah sh'ola is not an issue, you're allowed to sit in a borrowed sukkah, and karka in nigzula, so there's no problem of it being stolen in the first place, as long as it's attached to the ground. Yeah. Aval, but gazal eats in the sikach behen. What if a person steals wood, this is your case, a person steals wood and uses it for schach, or for the walls for that matter, and then everybody agrees, even Rabbi Eliezer, that all he's owed now is the value of the wood. You don't have to. The sukkah itself is kosher. In other words, if he steals wood and makes sukkah out of it, then now you have shinui ma'aseh because a different action has been done with it, and shinui hashem. It now has a different name. Before it was called wood. Now it's called the sukkah. And besides which, we're going to get to. Rashi points out. We're going to get in the next couple of lines. The Gemara is going to talk about the concept of takanas hashavin. Takanas HaShavin is like this. Midah Raisa, a person steals something, he has to return the thing itself, unless there's a shinui in it. Unless it was tainet b'shinui.
Can I say
the
shinui is
gazel? No. What if you have, for example, if a person were to steal a piece of wood from somebody else and then build it into his house? Midah Raisa, he would actually have to tear down the house when he's ready to do tshuva. He would have to tear down the house to take out that beam of wood and return it to the guy he stole it from. But the Chachamim realized that's going to make it very hard for a person to do tshuva. So therefore, they made a concept called takanas hashavim. That's actually the Mishnah and Git mentioned a number of such takanas. This is one of them that in that case we don't make him return the actual beam. We allow him to just return the value of it. And that way it'll be easier for him to do tshuva. The Medrash brings, incidentally, that when Yonah went to Nineveh to warn them, and they turn over the city with tshuva, the pasuk says that the king announces that everybody should get rid from any of the ill-gotten gains that are in their possession. So the Medrash says that they went according to the letter of the halacha, according to what it says, midaraita, in this kind of thing. Somebody had stolen a beam from somebody else, he would actually tear down his house to give back the beam to the guy he had stolen it from. And this is the kind of thing that the Avish just saw, that, you know, they're serious about this.
What amount of money would you give the beam?
The value of the beam.
When it was stolen?
Yeah, when it was stolen. Yeah. Anyway, so the same thing of... Not necessarily, actually. There are times when you pay Keshas HaGzela, there are times when you pay Keshas HaAveda. There's Gemara's about it in Bava Metzia and some other places. It's not necessarily so simple. Yeah. Anyway, here we have a person stole wood and used it to build a sukkah. As the Gemara is going to say soon, we apply takanas hashavim to that. We're not going to make him tear down his sukkah to return that stolen wood. We'll allow him to get away with just paying the value of it.
Even if the owner wants the beam?
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second, yeah. So divrei hakol ein eladmei etzim. So everybody, even Rabbi Eliezer, agrees that the owner is only entitled to the value of the wood, and therefore you can't call that a sukkah gzula. Now, before we talk about, and it's brought in Shulchan Aruch, are we talking about, indeed, that the gazlan actually paid the guy before Yom Tov, or would it work even, for example, if he's only going to pay him after Yom Tov, or what if he never pays him, you know, would it be considered retroactively sukkah gzula? Those are all different issues, but yeah. Mimai, how do we know that? Mitkatani, jumia, durashos rabim, because what did the Braita say? The Braita had given two cases. Number one, where a person steals a sukkah, and number two, where a person sets up a sukkah in rashos rabim, which... And therefore, Jumya Durashus Rabim. So therefore, we have to say the stolen sukkah has to be similar to one that's in Rashus Rabim. Ma Rashus Rabim Kauka Labdideh, who just like a Rashus Rabim is a place where the Kauka does not belong to you. Sukkanami Lab Kauka Didehu. The same thing, when we talk about a stolen sukkah, it has to mean that we're talking about where the land itself does not belong to you. But if the land actually belongs to you, and you just stole somebody else's wood, then that's not what the Braita is talking about, then there's no machlokes about that. Yes, that's basically what we're saying. So, but again, according to Rashi, you would have the one case where a sukkah could actually be considered stolen if it's not attached to the ground at all, like a sukkah on a wagon. And according to Tosfos, you could have the case again where a person builds a sukkah in somebody else's property without his permission, and then the owner of the property throws him off it. and keeps the sukkah. Yeah. So Gemara tells a story in this connection. Hashi Savta, there was this old lady, the Asoi Kameid Rav Nachman. She came in front of Rav Nachman with a complaint. Amrale, she says to him, Reish Galusa, Chula Rabbanan, the political leader of all the Jews in Babel, and all the Rabbanan, all the Chachamim, who are all in the house of the Reish Galusa, the Sukkah Gzula, Havayasvi, they're all sitting in a stolen sukkah, because the servants of the Reish Galusa had gone and taken some of her wood and used it to make their sukkah. So she comes to Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman was a dayan in town, and we find in many places in the Gemara also that he was very much involved in what's going on in the house of Reish Galusa. So evidently she figured that he'll be the one to do something about this. So she's saying they're all sitting in a stolen sukkah because they stole my wood. Sabcha, she was screaming about this. V'lo ashkach bar Rav Nachman, and Rav Nachman didn't pay attention to her. One second. Well, let's get through the story, and then I'll tell you what a number of mafarshim say about this. Amr Alei, so she says, "Haytachen, you're ignoring me. Itza dehavalei la'avu atlas meyer atzman esrei avdi, a woman who her ancestor had 318 servants, which is Abraham Avinu. We know when he went to fight against the Dain. By Yarek Atchanichav, the pasuk says he got together all of his trained men, shloshmona atzer shloshmeis, 318." So she's saying, Haytochen, my ancestor had 318 servants. Such a person, Sacha Kamaycha, was screaming in front of you, and you're not paying any attention to her? Apparently. Yeah. But wait, I'll tell you. Amalahu Rav Nachman, so Rav Nachman says to the people around him, Pi'isahida, this is a noisy kind of person. Like she's yelling a lot. But the fact is, she's only entitled to the value of her wood. She's not entitled to tell the Reish Galusa and company to tear down their sukkah and then give her back the wood. Now, what's taka going on over here? Why is Rav Nachman ignoring her? Why, of all things, is she mentioning this, that Avraham Avinu had to, she wants to mention, I'm a daughter of Avraham Avinu, fine, but the greatest thing you can think of Avraham is that he had 318 retainers. I mean, you know, and what's going, why is Rav Nachman ignoring her, and why is he calling her like a derogatory name? He does this, is like a noisy person. There's a number of different mafarshim on it. One of them, Ksav Sofer, says an interesting idea. The Gemara is going to actually say soon, the Gemara is going to get to in a few lines, that if the person, that after Sukkot, yes, you do have to return the person his actual wood. Only during Sukkot, you have to give him money. Because during Sukkot, we say Takonas HaShavim. After Sukkot, you're taking down your Sukkot anyway. There's no Takonas HaShavim anymore. Yeah. So therefore, the Ksav Sofer says, what happened was, this lady is coming and screaming about I want my wood back. So Rav Nachman is ignoring her and then afterwards saying, like, you know, she's a noisy one, because he actually meant it for her benefit. He was trying to say, you know what, calm down. If you calm down and leave the thing till after Sukkot, then you'll get your actual wood back. If you want your actual wood back, don't go complain about it now. Now there's nothing I can do for you. Takanas HaShavim. Wait till after Yom Tov, and then if you want to go, then you can come complain about it and you'll get back your actual wood.
Maybe she just wanted the money.
If she wanted the actual money, then yeah, but she was claiming they're sitting in a stolen sukkah. So that's one explanation. Maybe to make for her own sukkah, maybe for firewood, who knows what, whatever. The article there, I think it is, says that what happened over here was, this was on Yom Tov. Yom Tov, you're not supposed to usually be sitting down at the basin. So this lady is coming with her complaint. Rav Nachman didn't want to have to deal with it on Yom Tov.
Right.
So at first he's ignoring it. Basically, you know, come back after Yom Tov. But she's screaming and saying, you're all sitting in a stolen sukkah. So Rav Nachman was worried, if so, you know, people are going to start thinking, you know, people are going to start being choshed, the Reish Galusa, and all that Abanan over there, that they're sitting in a stolen sukkah. We can't have that. Nevertheless, he didn't want to actually pask in the din on Yom Tov. So, like, he turns to the people around him and says, you know, P'isahidah, you know, all she gets is the money. Like, in other words, he meant it kind of to address it to her, but not directly, so as not to be dan the din on Yom Tov. So, like, he's telling the people around, you should know, the din in such a case would be that she's only entitled to the money.
Yeah, but that leaves open the fact that maybe people would have thought, you know, she's right, she's not denying anything.
No, so that's what we're saying. In other words, like this, by pointing out that all she's entitled to is the money, effectively, he's not pointing directly to her, but he's mentioning to the people around him who are sitting all there in the sukkah or in the basin shtibble or wherever this was taking place, that you should know, don't suspect for a second that, in fact, she's right, the Resh Galusa and company are sitting in a stolen sukkah. They're not. The fact is, she's only entitled to the money for it. But that's why he didn't actually tell it to her. He didn't tell her, you're only entitled to the money, because that would be judging a din on Yom Tov, din Torah on Yom Tov, and you're not supposed to do that. As far as why she mentioned about the 318 servants, there's also a whole bunch of different explanations on it. There's a few of them, Chassam Sofer says, and there's a couple of other achronim that relate it to the idea that we see that Avraham had, the pasuk describes over there at the end of the war with Sodom, that the king of Sodom offers Avraham all the booty, and Avraham says, I'm not going to take anything, but he says, Bil Adai, it's beyond me, I'm not going to take anything. Rak Asha Achwan Arim, but there's only, I mean, the fact is, my boys, my 318 servants did eat some stuff, and, you know, what can I do? I mean, that's, you know, what's done is done, basically. So we see from that, therefore, that even a tzaddik like Avraham can have servants who are not necessarily so on the up and up. They're eating things that don't belong to them in the heat of the battle. So therefore, she's arguing, Mela, fine, I can accept the Resh Galusa, a great guy. But obviously, he has servants who are Rishayim. No, he's no better than Avraham Avinu in that regard. And therefore, Rav Nachman answers that you're right, they shouldn't have taken the wood in the first place. But the fact is, you can't say that they're sitting in a stolen sukkah and you should make them take down the wood right now. You can't do that.
She has said, I don't have a sukkah.
That would be different.
Yeah.
I mean, she's just saying, you're sitting in a stolen sukkah. I want my wood back. Maybe she wants it for firewood. Maybe.
We don't know.
That's true. Women aren't obligated in sukkah. That's a good point. Yeah.
What happened? They acquired it with Shinui Maiseh?
So they acquired it in three ways, basically. Shinui Maiseh, because they made it into a sukkah. Shinui Hashem, because before it was just called wood, and now it's called a sukkah. And number three, Takanas HaShavim, that when a person steals something and builds it into their house, that we don't make him tear down his house, and in the same way we don't make him tear down his sukkah. Takanas HaShavim, the takana of the people who are going to do tshuva, make it easier for them to do tshuva, basically. If a person knew he has to tear down his house in order to do complete tshuva, then he'll just say, forget about it, I can't be bothered.
Just shows the power, because he's always able to dictate that, and like Hashem's rule.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a general rule throughout Shas that Hefka based in Hefka, that based in has a lot of latitude when it comes to Dini Mominus. So yes, Beis Din is allowed to say that even though Midaraisa, this beam actually belongs to the original owner, but Midrabanan, we're going to take it away from him and just make him entitled only to the value of it. Yeah. I saw also a different explanation, B'pnimius in Yanim, that 318 is three times the word kav, like a line, so that she's saying something like, you know, we come from Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, we have all three kavim of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, totaling 318. So if Yishmael, for example, only had the one kav of Avraham, and Hashem still listened to his cries when he's over there under one of the bushes crying from thirst, how much more so Yehuda of Nachman should be listening to me?
Kuf vav
is kav, is a line, and is 106, and three times that is 318. Amar Ravina. Ravina says, "Haik shura dimitalal to digzula. If you have a beam from the sukkah that was stolen, abdi the rabbanan." So before we were talking about, for example, just wood that a person uses for the schach or maybe for the walls. Here we're talking about a person steals a beam and actually builds it into their sukkah. So same thing, abdi the rabbanan. Takanta mishum takanas marish. The rabbanan made a takana that he does not have to tear down his sukkah. He's allowed to keep that and use the sukkah during the sukkah because of this takanas marish, the takanas hashavim that we just said. Marish means a big beam. So this takanas hashavim is a generic term for the various takanas that the Chacham made in order to make it easier for a ganav or a gazlan to do tshuva. Another one of them actually is that if you have a person who most of what he owns comes from gneva or gzela, we actually don't make him return it at all. And not only we don't make him return it, but in fact if he wants to return it, we tell the people who he stole from not to accept it from him. Same idea, because then he's going to figure, you know, he's going to end up with nothing, and then he's just going to give up on doing tshuva altogether. So all these different kinds of dinim are called in general takanas hashavim. The specific one that we're saying about the beam is called takanas morish, the takana of the beam. So here we're saying, same idea, you took a beam, you built it into your sukkah, you don't have to return that beam, you just have to return the money. Right, but we're saying we don't want him to do that, but we don't want to make him do that because then he may say, you know what, it's too much trouble to tear down my house, forget about it, I'm not going
to
do shiva.
Or he'll do it, but other people won't be able to do it.
Yeah, okay. Ask Pshita, Maishnama Asim. Well, of course, why is a beam any different than wood than regular wood? The answer is Maudatema Asim Shri, you might have thought. Wood is a very common thing. It's easy to find wood. It's easy to find more wood for Sas. But maybe a beam is not such an easy to find thing. Maybe Taka, we should say if somebody bought a beam, you know, somebody went to Home Depot before sukkahs and bought themselves a big beam to use as a center post of their sukkah, and you stole it from them. Maybe Taka, you should say give it back to them because it's not going to be so easy to find another one. Kamash Malon, that's the chiddush. That no, we don't say that. We the Tachanas Marish applies across the board.
It was a metal beam of
the pastures would be the same thing. Hani mili begoy shiva. Now, all this is only talking about during the 7 days of Sukkot. Avalabas of shiva, but after 7 days, hadabene, then you have to actually give the beam back, because then you're tearing down your sukkah. There's no more takana sashavim. Which is why, the Sab Sefer was saying in connection with that story with the woman, that if she had, you know, that Rav Nachman was telling her, basically, you know, leave well enough alone until after Sukkot, and you'll get your wood back. But if you're going to demand it during Sukkot, then you're only going to be entitled to the money. The ichibre betina, on the other hand, what if the person took this beam and actually attached it to the ground or to the wall or whatever with cement? You know how you have people who leave some of the framework up of their sukkah up all year round and they just put on new schach every year. So here we're talking about that. Somebody did that. He took this beam and actually attached it to the ground or whatever. So then it becomes like a regular thing. After the achashiv anavi, even after the 7 days of sukkah, so it's attached permanently. So yoyvle dami, you only have to give him money. Okay, so that now finishes the sugya now on a stolen sukkah. So now so to summarize then, if you stole the land where the sukkah is, then you have then we said it's machlokes Rabbi Eliezer and the Chachamim, whether that's considered gzela or not. And if you stole the materials for the sukkah, then we're saying that you are kind of them. Therefore you don't have to return them during sukkah, and you are allowed to use that sukkah. But again, in Shulchan Aruch it says that in such a case you shouldn't make a bracha on such a sukkah because it's like making fun of Hashem. Like you did an aveira and now you're praising Hashem for the mitzvah that you're doing with it. Yeah, it would be blaspheming Hashem. So making a sukkah in Rosh Hashanah Abim, so actually there's an interesting thing that it does mention that in Shulchan Aruch, that you can't make a sukkah in Rosh Hashanah Abim, because even if the Jews in town are willing to be meichel, but there's goyim in town, they're not going to be meichel, you're stealing it from them. In practice, of course, you do see that there are people who make sukkahs in some places in Rosh Hashanah Abim. You see, although, you know, in front of some of the stores on Kingston and whatnot, they put up sukkahs in Rosh Hashanah Abim.
And you make a
bracha eating them. But pashtus, I guess they get permission from the city. If they get permission from the same way as we say in other areas of halacha, in Eruvin, for example, that all you need is permission from the mayor or city council or what have you, and then you don't need to get permission from every individual guy in town, the pashtus, so the same thing would apply as far as a sukkah on the sidewalk.
There's also today I know people get they're responsible for the street.
So therefore, you want to say that maybe
in a way that if you're responsible for the clean, I'm. The sidewalk in front of my house breaks. Even though it's a shazam, they make me responsible. Since the government makes me so responsible, all the stores for the front thing, that a way they have an owner, government.
Yeah, but the point about Rosh Hashanah Abim is that you have a shutfus with everybody in the town on it. You own the sidewalk, fine, but so does everybody else. They have a right to walk on it.
Right.
So it's not necessarily so simple. There is an interesting thing, a number of Mefarshim bring a pasuk in Nehemiah that describes that when they built sukkahs in Yerushalayim early in the time of the Second Mishmikdash, and it describes that they built them in several public squares, Rechov Shara Mayim, or Rechov Shara Ephraim. So how does that work according to this? The one answer they give is that Yerushalayim at that time was all Jews. Therefore, there's not an issue. As long as all Jews in town give permission for it, then you're fine.
They would be the same.
Yerushalayim is not an old Jew. Mostly, it's not all Jews.
Old Jews.
Not all Jewish. You go to a place like Kfar Chabad, maybe even such a thing could work, yeah. Now, moving on to the next thing, the Mishnah had meant. So now we're done with the stolen lulav. Now on to the next thing. The Mishnah had said a dry lulav. Tana, we learn in a braisa, yavish posel, a dry lulav is posel, Rabbi Yehuda Mashe, and Rabbi Yehuda says it's kasha. So, Amar Rav, machloikas belulav, the machloikas specifically is only about the lulav. The Rabbanan Savri Makshin and lulav, the Estrug, the Rabbanan hold that we make a hekish between the lulav and the Estrug. My Estrug boy hodder, ap lulav boy hodder. Just like the Estrug has to be hodder, that's a given, because the Torah calls it priyat hodder. So the same thing, all the other minim mentioned in that pasuk, the lulav, the hadas, and the arava, all have to be hadar as well. Rabbi Yehuda, Savalai Machshin and lulav last week, whereas Rabbi Yehuda holds that you do not make that hekesh. So Rashi says, actually, that...
You should say Machshin on Esrog lulav.
No, lulav Esrog. We're comparing the lulav to the Esrog, where the Esrog is where we want to learn from, because there's hadar by the Esrog. The Chachamim say that we learn from that to the lulav, from the Esrog to the lulav, yeah.
So what do we say Machshin?
That's the expression, Machshin, and we compare the lulav, Esrog, to the Esrog, which is the derivative, which is where we're deriving it from. Aval, but Esrog, Dibre Hakol, Hadar, Be'inin. But when it comes to Esrog, everybody would agree it has to be Hadar, so therefore, for example, Rabbi Yehuda would agree that an Esrog can't be dried out, for example. So Rashi has an interesting thing about this, that Rashi says that the point of the machlokas between the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda is the Chachamim hold that you can come up with a Hekesh on your own, and Rabbi Yehuda holds you can't. Now, we do know there is a general rule that you can't make a person can't come up with a Gzeir Shava on their own. Rashi says that actually that applies to most of the Tamidus Chatur and Adreshus Behem. You can't come up with on your own. The only one you can come up with on your own, Rashi says, is a Kal V'Chomer. But all the other ones, Zeta Shava, and Hekesh, Binyan Abnikal, Tzavachar, etc., you need to have the Kabbalah. Yeah. Tosfos argues, you have to have the Kabbalah. You have to have learned from your teachers. Tosfos argues on that. Tosfos says, what are you talking about? There's no question that a Hekesh, you can douse on it. There's no question. A Hekesh, you can douse on your own. So, on the contrary, the only one that you can't douse on your own is a Gzeira Shava. So therefore, Tosfos says, you know why we would be saying that Rabbi Yehuda doesn't hold that Hadar applies to the Lulav and the other Minim? Because the word Hadar, according to the way we're looking at it now, the word Hadar only applies to fruit. The Esrog is a fruit. The other three are not. It's not Shayach to speak of, according to Rabbi Yehuda, a Lulav or a Hadas or an Arava, that's Hadar. Because the definition of Hadar means a beautiful fruit. So that's what Tosfos is saying, yeah. So that would be, in other words, why we would say that Rabbi Yehuda would hold that a dry lulav is kosher. So you might ask, why? Well, lulav like Rabbi Yehuda hadar? You're telling me that Rabbi Yehuda does not hold that a lulav has to be hadar? Well, that's not, but we learned in the Mishnah. We have the case of the Mishnah where you have a lulav, which is already, the lulav is already starting to mature. The leaves are already starting to spread apart from the shedra. And we said, the Chachamim said it's kosher without any problem. Rabbi Yehuda, I mean, Yagzen, or Milamayla. And Rabbi Yehuda says you have to tie it together on top. You have to bend the leaves back towards the shedra and tie them together. And that's the question. My time, a lot, Mishum Debay Hadar. Lachora, the reason would be because Rabbi Yehuda holds that the lulav has to be Hadar. If it's got its leaves open, it's not so Hadar. Therefore, you have to make it look like it's Hadar. So we see you need Hadar by the lulav also. The answer is loy. No, not necessarily. Kitkatani Taima. The reason could be because it says in a Braisa. Rabbi Yehuda, I'm a Mishum Reb Tachrin. When the pasuk says Kapos Tmarim, a branch of a palm tree, the word Kapos we can also read as if it said Kapos. It means as if it said kapus, tied together. So therefore, vim hara parod. So if it's separated, yichpesenu, you actually have to tie it, you have to actually bind it and tie it back together. So nothing to do with hadar, just because the Torah defines it as kapus tmarim.
Even if that creates the
hiddur, it doesn't matter. Right, because the hiddur is not the essential point, exactly. Okay, how about another possibility? Lloyd by Hadar, you're telling me that Rabbi Yehuda does not hold the lulav has to be Hadar. Ratnan, we learn later in the Perek, Ein Ogdin as a lulav elabiminoi. You can only bind the lulav with its own kind of thing, meaning you have to use one of the actual Dalad Minim, or something that comes from one of the Dalad Minim trees to bind the lulav. Divir Rabbi Yehuda. And my time, and now why would that be? Lav Mishum Dabai Hadar? Wouldn't that be because we would assume because he says the lulav has to be Hadar? The answer is no. Why? Da'ama Rava, because after all, Rava said it doesn't. When we say bimino, it doesn't necessarily mean, for example, that you have to use a lulav leaf or a hadas branch or what have you.
To tie it up.
It can be anything that comes from one of those plants. For example, afilu b'siv. You can even use, for example, siv, which is a kind of vine that grows around the bottom of a palm tree. It's considered part of the palm tree also. You can even use a piece of the peel of the not the peel the bark of the palm tree. Now the sieve or the bark don't look particularly beautiful. The bark of the tree. You know? The bark, you know, like you have on the outside of the trunk. The brown covering on the outside of a tree.
Oh.
Yeah. Now neither of those are particularly beautiful. So obviously, if Rabbi Yehuda is saying that you can use those, he's not saying it has nothing to do with Hadar. the Elamai time of the Rabbi Yehuda. So what taka is Rabbi Yehuda's reason? Chasam is because the Kasava, because he holds lulav tzrich eged. He holds the mitzvah of lulav. You have to bind the minim together. The imaisi min achrina. So therefore, in order to be yotz of the mitzvah, the imaisi min achrina. So therefore, if you were to bring in another min, have a lul chamisha minim, and you're going to have five minim, and that would be bal tosif. So in other words, nothing to do with hadar. He says you have to use, for example, a lulav. You have to use lulav leaves or sieve or what have you, because that way you're still keeping to four kinds of plants. So it has nothing to do with hadar. If you were to use anything else, if you were to use, for example, the Gemara mentioned, the Mishnah mentions, but in this machlokas of Yehuda and the Chachamim point out to Yehuda that the people of Yerushalayim used to use golden wires to bind their lulavim, which is a different myth. No, not sieve. They use golden wire.
No, I understand, but yeah. What sieve is not a different thing.
Sieve is not a different thing, because it comes from a palm tree, after all. It's not the same exact thing you use for lulav, but at least it's from the same myth. Yeah.
That's why we use the same rings.
So we do. I mean, in practice, we do. We use lulav rings, but technically, the halacha is like the chachamim, that lulav ain't tzarich eged, that technically you do not have to bind the minim together in order to be yotz of the mitzvah. It's a matter of hidur mitzvah to do that, but you don't have to. Technically, even if you were to pick up the lulav and then the hadassim and then the aravos and then the esrog, you would be okay. No, or even if you picked them up one after the other, actually, you're not supposed to. And in fact, in Shulchan Aruch it brings a thing from the Rikanti about the importance of not keeping the esrog apart from the other three minim. Something along the lines of that you hold them together, you hold them apart at first when you're first making the bracha, but then you make sure to hold them together for the actual for the end of the bracha and for the nanuim. And then Shulchan Aruch in I think the Magen Avraham brings from the Rikanti that there was one time a chassid named Rabbi Yitzchak who he himself did, or maybe he dreamt about somebody else who did. I don't remember who he dreamt. He saw in a dream the name Yudkei Vavkei, that the letters Yudkei Vav are written together, and then the hey is written separately from them. And he realized that's related to this idea of holding the esrog separately from the three minim that he had done. He was doing wrong by that. But me'ikar adin, you are yotze that way. So therefore, you don't have to bind them at all. And if you're binding them, you can bind them with whatever you want, technically. So yeah, in practice, we bind them with lulav leaves, but you don't have to. Whereas according to Rabbi Yehuda, you have to.
When I traveled to go around, he called it
Okay, but that's for the Hashinus. I mean, you've already been yotz of the mitzvah at that point. You're carrying around for the Hashinus as more of a hidur mitzvah. We'll talk about actually on Amud Beis about the possibilities of holding the lulav and esrog together in one hand. Wait. Okay, but now the question is, the Gemara asks, okay, so far, fine, we seem to have established that Rabbi Yehuda does not hold that the lulav has to be hotter. Both of the cases that we find that he seems to, we have other reasons why he says it. Because it has to be kafos, or because you can't add to the mitzvah. Now, let's go the other way. Over esrog mi boyer Rabbi Yehuda hotter. So now you're telling me when it comes to esrog, Rabbi Yehuda holds that it has to be hotter. Which, not necessarily. We're going to actually have, you know, we're assuming that the word hadar means beautiful, but the Gemara is actually going to discuss on Daf Lamed Hey, which we'll get to in a few days, Bez Hashem, that there are actually a number of different, there's like half a dozen different Tanoim who have different drushes of what the word hadar really means. Not necessarily does it mean beautiful. It means hadar b'ilana mishana l'shana, that it stays on the tree from one year to the next. It's related to the Greek word idur, which means water. And so it's a kind of tree that needs a tremendous amount of water to grow, which is true of a tzrogim. But a lot of different explanations of what hadar means. Not necessarily does it mean beautiful.
Yeah,
we'd have to change the pronunciation to idur or whatever. Yeah, okay.
Take a Greek word to understand.
It's not the only place we do that.
Greek is supposed to be very.
Another example is when the Torah says, here's an example in Parshas Vayishlach, when it talks over there about how Devora, Rivka's nurse, died, and they made a hesped for her, and they buried her by alon bachus. Rashi says over there the word alon is Greek for other. So it hints to the fact that besides the crying for Devora, there was another crying because Rivka passed away at the same time also. But yeah, there are a number of places where we douse in a word in the Torah as if it was a Greek word, yeah. True, Kaspi Stein, Kaspi Stein, yeah.
Yeah, but
this is also there, yeah. And what do you think we're talking about? What do you think we're learning? I mean, anyway.
Yeah.
But we're saying, in other words, the same way as we douse in that word alone, for example, to mean other, the same way, yeah. So, does Rabbi Yehuda really hold that the Esrog has to be Hadar? Maybe he darshens the word Hadar like one of the other, like one of the other drashas. And in fact, Vahatanya, we learn in a brisa, Arbas Minim Shabalulav, the four Minim in the Lulav, Kashem Shain Pachsin Mehen, just like you're not allowed to do less than them, you have to make sure you have all four Minim, Kachen Masifna Lehem, so you're not allowed to add to them. It would be about Tigra or Vatosin. Loy Mata Esrog, what happens if you don't find an Esrog? Loyavi, like Parish, Vilay Rimon, you should not take a Parish, which is a quince, is a kind of fruit that looks a little bit like an apple, or a Rimon, a pomegranate, Vilay Javacha, or anything else. And the brisa continues, Kmushin Ksherin, if the Dalit Minim are wilted, so like they're starting to dry out, but they're not completely dried out yet, then they're kosher. Yevashin Psulin, but if they're dry, they're possel. Rabbi Yehuda, I'm after Yevashin. Rabbi Yehuda says, even if they're dry, they're kosher. Ve Amar Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Yehuda says, I can prove it to you. Maisa Bibnei Krachin, it happened with people who live in big cities, where big cities, they don't live any place near where it's possible to get lulavim, for example. Shoyim Arishin, that's lulavim, b'nei, and they would give their lulavim as inheritance to their grandchildren.
Wow.
They kept the same lulav in the family for generations. Which, Mepharshim say, it doesn't necessarily mean they kept on using that lulav. Obviously, I mean, even if they're living in a big city, it's not like they can never get a lulav. It means that not necessarily, was it a given every year, so that therefore they'd bequeath these lulavim to their grandchildren in case one year it should happen. You don't have lulav available, use this one.
That's
b'diavad, right. But the point is, even though it's b'diavad, the fact is we see they did use it.
Right.
Even though it's dried out. Amr lahem, or Amr lahi, so the Chacham answer back to him, Misham Raya, you bring a proof from there. And Shasat Chak Raya, you can't bring a proof from Shasat Chak, yeah. So in Shulchan Aruch, actually, it talks about the pros and cons. When are and aren't you allowed to use dried out dalav minim? Sometimes, if indeed, if it's a shatat chak and you don't have anything else available, then you can take a dry one. Whether you make a bracha on it is another machloek is shreinim. But yeah. Anyway, katani mi yisur b'chodem a'afyevashim shedim. A lot of times. But here we're saying that b'shatat chak. In other words, unlike we said, we just said on Amud Aleph, and the Gemara is going to explain in a minute, that for example, if you don't have an esrog, you can't take an apple instead. That's a given. But on the other hand, if you don't have a fresh lulav, you can take a dry one. Whether you make a bracha on it as a machlokas or shoyim, but at least you can. You don't say you're going to take a dry. Well, you know what? When we get to the parish and rimon thing, we'll get to in a minute. Anyway, katani mi, Rabbi Yehuda, I'm an activation trader. The point is, we see Rabbi Yehuda says that even dried out ones are kosher. My lava esrog. Can't we assume that he's talking about the esrog as well? It sounds like he's talking about all the dalav minim. The answer is, a lulav, not necessarily. He might only be talking about the lulav and the other minim, not necessarily. Would he agree that an esrog is good if it's dry? So he might well say that, yes, the esrog has to be harder, but not the other three minim. Let's go through the braise. So Amamar, Kashem Shane Person Mehan Kachen Mistiknale, and just like you're not allowed to subtract from the Dalad Minim, so you're not allowed to add to them. Pshita, isn't that obvious? Of course, Loisigra and Loisozi. The answer is Mao the Tema. You might have thought Hoyov Amr of Yehuda Lulav Tzarech Eged, since, as we just said before, Rabbi Yehuda holds that the Lulav does have to be bound. If you don't bind it together, you don't accomplish the mitzvah. Therefore, the imaisi min achrina. So what would happen if he's bringing in a different min? Suppose that together with the dalad minim, he's holding a fifth kind of branch, but he doesn't tie it together with the other ones. So then ha'ilachudekoy. You might have thought that each one stands on its own. He has a dalad minim. Along with it, he's holding, let's say, an olive branch. There's no bal tosif over there because in order for it to be considered part of the thing, he'd have to actually have tied it together with it. Kamash Malon, that's the chiddush that Rabbi Yehuda is saying that you can't even add something in that way, even if it's being held separately. According to the Rabbanon, we say lulav ein tzarech eged. Needless to say, of course, that would be a problem because whether you bind them together or not, then you still have moisis. Mufashim, by the way, talk about the question when we say that you're not allowed to add. What about, does that mean you're not allowed to add a fifth min, but you're allowed to add more of the other kinds of minim? We know, as a practical matter, we don't add to the esrog or the lulav or the aravis, but we do feel free to add to the hadassim. Because the more hadassim you have, the more of a hiddur mitzvah it is. Amamar, the Brai said, lo matzah esrog, lo yovi, lo rimin, lo parish, lo java acher, that if you can't find an esrog, you shouldn't take pomegranate or quince or anything else. Again, the question is pshita. Of course, the Torah says you have to take an esrog, and that's that. The answer is Ma'od Tema. You might have thought Lysi, at least you should use one of those things. Ki'echish le'tashtak of Torah's Esrog, in order that you don't completely forget about the concept that you have to have an Esrog. Mashmalon, that's the Chiddush. Don't even do that. Zimnid nafik chuv aminei. It could happen that a destructive thing will come out of it. The asil misrach. You're going to come to make a mistake. You're not going to realize last year I used an apple because I didn't have an esrog. You're going to start thinking, or other people around you are going to start thinking. The fact is, after all, the Torah doesn't specify what the dalad minim are, except for the arava. All the other ones, it's just by implication. Priya Tadra, we know the Kabbalah means an esrog, but it doesn't actually say so in so many words. So a person might get mixed up and then start thinking that it's something else. So in Shulchan Aruch, it actually talks about, what if, for example, what if a person does not have all the dalad minim? Can he take three of the minim, obviously without a bracha? So that would not be considered Bal Tigra, because he doesn't have a choice. And he is allowed to do that. We're not afraid that he's going to think to himself in future years that there are only three minims. And the fact is, the Torah does say 4 minims. On the other hand, what we're saying over here is don't use something else instead of the esrog, because then you may think that, okay, the 4 minim includes an apple, a lulav, a hadas, and an arav, etc. You might not remember. And then as far as going back to a dry lulav, then similar idea. In Shulchan Aruch it says that you can't, if you don't have a fresh lulav, you can use a dry one, the same thing with the other minim. But, and again, the reason is, you're not afraid that the person is going to think, I use a dry lulav, therefore in future years I can use a dry lulav. A person's going to realize that, you know, a person's going to realize I'm supposed to use a fresh one when possible, and it was just a shasat chak and I couldn't get a hold of one. Tashma, come, let's bring another proof. Esrog a yoshan pasul, an old esrog is pasul for Rabbi Yehuda Machsher, and Rabbi Yehuda says it's kosher. Old, meaning it's over a year old, where definitely it's going to be dried out. There's no way you can keep an esrog fresh for a year. Tiyuv to the Rabba. So this is a contradiction to Rabba. Rabba was saying that Rabbi Yehuda holds that the esrog has to be hadar, and the other three minim do not. We see now from this that Rabbi Yehuda holds even the esrog doesn't have to be hadar. The answer is, yeah, tiyuv to. It is a contradiction. But now we have the opposite problem. Still, you're telling me Rabbi Yehuda says the esrog does not have to be hadar. But we learn in a later Mishnah in this Perek, hayorek kauti, an esrog which is green like a leek. And Tosfos, by the way, spent a little while up here in the Tosfos hayorek defining what exactly does yorek mean in Gemara terminology anyway. In some places, yorek means yellow. In some places, it means green. And in some places, Tosfos says it even sounds like it means blue. Obviously, a sirgim aren't blue. On the other hand, we're clearly not talking about yellow, because an asterisk is yellow when it's white. We are talking about green, that's why it has to specifically say yorek kauti, because if it just said yorek, you wouldn't know which of those colors we're talking about. Kauti means like a leek. So an esrog that's green like a leek, Rab Meir Machshir v'Rab Yehuda Paisel. Rab Meir says it's kosher, Rab Yehuda says it's pasel. Now, lav mishum debay hader, again, we would assume, why would Rabbi Yehuda say that a green esrog is possible? Because it's not hader. And therefore, you'd see that Rabbi Yehuda does say, you need the esrog to be hader. The answer is, why? Not necessarily. Mishum delay gomar pera. The reason is, because if it's green, it means it's not, the fruit itself is not finished yet. Meaning, in other words, the Torah is saying you have to have pre eight hader, you have to have a fruit. If it's still green, if it's still unripe, it's not a fruit yet. I don't know necessarily because you can't eat it yet. The truth is, Tosfos discusses the issue over here that we don't necessarily mean. I mean, you have a lot of times you go to an esrog store and they have lots of esrogim that are still green, but those are not those. You know, all you have to do, you put them in with an apple or whatever, you know, the different kinds of things people do, and it'll turn yellow in a few days. What we're talking about over here, green esrog that we're arguing whether it's kosher or pasul, is actually if it's an unripe. If it's small and green, where there it's clearly not ripe yet. Even if you were to take a small green esrog like that and put it together with an apple, it's not going to turn yellow because it hasn't grown enough yet to ripe. That's the kind of thing we're talking about. Having said that, though, the fact is, the fact is, poskim do talk about that a green esrog is no. So Mephoshim discuss over here when we're saying over here that a green esrog is no good because loigama pera, is that everybody agrees to that, or is it only Rabbi Yehuda who doesn't hold? We're saying Rabbi Yehuda does not hold an esrog has to be harder. He would say in and of itself a green esrog wouldn't be a problem, but the problem is that it's not a ripe fruit yet, and therefore it's a problem. Whereas the Chachamim would say you need harder. The Chachamim say that all 4 minim have to be harder, and maybe therefore a green esrog would be a problem on those grounds. So because of that, actually, yes, because not harder. And therefore, it actually says in Shulchan Aruch that you should not use a green esrog if you can help it. If it's a little green, is one thing. If it's already starting to become yellow, then that's one thing. There are actually svarim that quote, there's a zayar that seems to imply that esrog should be yorik. But again, based on the Tosfos over here, we see that yorik can mean yellow. And that's how that's in fact in Sefer Menhagim, whatever writes that we make sure to take it, that our minug is not to, there are some people who specifically have a minug based on that understanding of the Zohar to take an esrog that's still a little green, so it's still a little yorik, but the Rebbe brings there in Sefer Menhagim that no, we take one that's completely yellow because that's the meaning of yorik.
We know that yorik means also yellow.
We find in different places, for example, those places where the Gemara speaks of yorik being the color of an egg yolk. Egg yolks aren't green. On the other hand, there's places where it talks about, for example, that tchelas is a bit of a yorick color, is a bit of a greenish color, is a bit of a yorick color, where then yorick would have to mean blue. So Tosfos, that's what I'm saying. Tosfos goes through a number of places in Shas where we see the different possibilities. Yeah. Tashma, shear esrog cotton, the shear of the smallest possible esrog that you can use. Rabbi Meir Omer Ke'egos, Rabbi Yehuda says, Rabbi Meir says, if it's the size of a nut, like a walnut, Rabbi Yehuda Omer Ke'beta, Rabbi Yehuda says it has to be at least the size of an egg. Again, lav mishum debay hader, the chora wouldn't the reason be why Rabbi Yehuda says it has to be at least the size of an egg, because if it's less than that, it's not hader. That would show he holds the esrog has to be hader. And again, the answer is why mishum debay goma player. Same thing as the previous answer, that if it's less than a kebetza in size, then it's not even a completed fruit yet. It's not a ripe fruit yet. So even if it actually has turned yellow, which we were talking about the previous thing was that it was still green, here we're talking about even if it turned yellow, but if it's smaller than a kebetza, then it's not considered a complete fruit yet. He doesn't require Gemara Peira necessarily. Yeah, we'll get to it actually in a few days.
He does
require Hadar, but he might say that even Kegos can be considered Hadar. We'll get to it in a few days though. There's other deists on the subject. Does it have to be mature enough that if you were to plant the seeds from this esrog that they would grow into a new tree? That's another possibility. Toshma. The Mishnah continues, over gadol, what's the largest possible esrog you can use? Kadesh yechas shnayim biyada achas is if they're the size that you'd be able to hold two esrogim in one hand. Divrei Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yossi, I mean, no. Rabbi Yossi says the other way around. Afila echad b'shnei yadav. Even if it's one esrog that it takes both your hands to hold, then it's still fine. Now, my timer, l'chora, what's Rabbi Yehuda's reason? Why would he say that there's a maximum size for an esrog? Lav mishum debay hader. Wouldn't the reason be because he says that it has to be hader? If it's so big, then it's not hader anymore. It doesn't look like a beautiful thing. It looks like a monstrous thing. The answer is no. That's not the reason. The reason is, kivin to amar rabba lulav b'yamin v'esrog v'smel. The reason is that Rabba said you're supposed to hold the lulav in your right hand and the esrog in your left hand. And the reason for that is because the lulav, you have three minim, you have, Rashi says, the lulav, you have three minim together with it. You have the hadas and the arava. The esrog is only one. So therefore, you give precedence to the lulav and put it in your right hand. So, zimnin de machlefile, sometimes it happens that you get the two of them mixed up. You accidentally pick up the lulav in your left hand. Va'asil apuchinu, and then you have to switch them around. Va'asil ifsuli. Now, if the esrog is too big, then you might drop it as you're trying to switch hands, and then you'll drop it, and it'll get a hole or whatever, it'll become puzzle. The pitum will fall off, whatever the different possibilities are. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda is saying, nothing to do with hader. Practicality. Don't have too big an esrog, so that even if you have to switch, you'll be able to put the lulav and esrog together into your right hand, then take the esrog back with your left hand, and not drop it. So nothing to do with hader.
Did I
have an answer to that? So the halacha is not like Rabbi Yehuda in that regard. We'll have later in the parak, the Gemara mentions that one time Rabbi Akiva came to shul on Sukkot with an esrog that was so big that he had to carry it in on his shoulder.
There are literally those ones
There are. Esrogim are hadar b'ilana mishana l'shana, as the Gemara is going to say in a second. They stay on the tree from one year to the next. So yes, if an esrog grows on a tree for enough of a length of time, it will grow to be very, very big. Okay, so we've established after all that according to Rabbi Yehuda, there's no source that where he says that the esrog has to be hader. What about the pasuk says, pri eitz hader? And the answer is Ahu Hadrobi Lana Mishana Lashana. That means that he holds that what does the word priyetz hadar mean? It teaches us that it's an esrog because hadar means hadrobi ilana mishana lashana, that it stays on the tree from one year to the next. Which that's only true of an esrog. So therefore, he says, once I'm using the word hadar for that purpose, then I don't have it available to also teach me this din that any of the minim have to be hadar. But they don't according to him.
It stays on the tree, but does it stay as fresh?
Yeah, it keeps on growing. That's the point. Mishnah said shalasheira v'shalirani dachas, that a lulav from an asheira or an irani dachas is possible. And one says, what do you mean a shalasheira possible? You're telling me that a lulav from an asheira, a tree that was worshipped as an avodazara, is possible? Well, I'm a rabba, but didn't rabba say lulav shal avodazara lo yitil? A lulav from avodazara you should not take. Which what does it mean a lulav of avodazara? Rashi gives a couple of examples. That for example, you use it as a broom to sweep the floor in front of a genshke. Or, for example, that you have different kinds of idols in those days had different forms of worshiping them. We know we all know the famous ones about Pa'ur and Merkulis. So among them could be, suppose you have an Avodah Zarah where the normal way of worshiping it is to throw a lulav in front of it. So if somebody were to throw that lulav in front of it, it's called Tekrovis Avodah Zarah, something that was offered to Avodah Zarah. So lo yitzel, you should not take it for the mitzvah, you should not take it because Rashi says the mois lagavoya. It's disgusting to use something like that was used for Avodah Zarah to serve Hashem with. But the im not are kosher. But if you did, then it's kosher because even though these things are also b'hanah, even though anything is used for Avodah Zarah is also b'hanah, but the din is that mitzvahs lav lehonis nitnu. Mitzvahs are not considered a hanah. When you're doing the mitzvah of lulav, the fact that you have hanah from it doesn't matter. You're doing the mitzvah, Rashi says in a few places, the mitzvah is zeras melech. The Eivishter said to do it, so you got to do it whether you like it or not. So therefore, the any hanah that you get from it is not considered a hanah. Hashem has hanah from our mitzvahs, but that's why we're saying it's most like a boy. It's disgusting to use it to worship Hashem with, to serve Hashem with. But after all, you, the person, are not supposed to be getting hanah from it. And if you do, it doesn't matter. It's not considered a hanah in halacha. So therefore, b'di'evit, if you use such a lulav, it's kosher. So what does the Mishnah mean when it says that it's possible? The answer is hacha b'asheira de Moshe askin. And here we're talking about an asheira of Moshe. Which the din about that is it has to be burnt. Now what is an asheira of Moshe? Rashi says it means specifically, it means the kind of asheira that existed when the Jewish people came into Eretz Yisrael. Normally, an avodah zarah of a goy normally can be nisbatel. Normally, if a guy worships something as a avodah zarah, or used it to adorn an avodah zarah or whatever, he can be mevatel. He can decide I don't want to worship this anymore. And he does some action to it to be mevatel it, and then it becomes motzei b'hanah. We're still saying you shouldn't use it for the mitzvah, but a guy can be mevatel another guy's avodah zarah as long as the other guy who's mevatel is also an avodah zarah worshiper. A Muslim, for example, I don't think can be mevatel avodah zarah. Anyway,
so they needed to be
but when the Jewish people came into Eretz Yisrael, you have the goyim are worshiping Avodah Zarah all over the country, and the pasuk says you have to burn them. So therefore, they have to be burned. This is not the kind of thing where bittul helps. And the Gemara in Avodah Zarah actually has an interesting discussion about that. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah discusses the issue. Didn't Eretz Yisrael already belong to us from the time of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? So how are the goyim able to make the trees and whatnot in Oster anyway? If I have a tree, for example, or any kind of object, if I have a cup of soda and somebody else goes and bows down to that cup of soda as an avodah zarah, he can't make it all, or pours it in front of a getchka or whatever, he can't make it all, so it's not his. So how could the goyim make the trees and whatnot in Eretz Yisrael also? And the Gemara answer is because since the Yidden worshipped the egel azahav, which is a form of avodah zarah, that shows that they didn't mind avodah zarah. Therefore, from then on, the goyim who are worshipping Avodah Zarah in Eretz Yisrael are considered like they're shluchim. It's considered like they're doing it on behalf of the Jews. Therefore, they're able to aser it. The same way as if I gave somebody permission to take this cup of soda and pour it out for Avodah Zarah, it would become aser, even if I myself didn't do it. So by the same token, then, therefore, so all the trees, although the old Masheda trees in Eretz Yisrael had to be burnt. Some of Farshim say that more generally, the Gemara is not just talking about that, but it's talking more generally about an Avodah Zarah that belongs to a Jew, because the din is an Avodah Zarah of a goy can be nisbatel, and an Avodah Zarah that belongs to a Jew can never be. It has to be destroyed. Tosfos discusses all the pros and cons of that, because the Jews of Avodah Zarah actually have to be burned, maybe it only has to be buried, a whole long discussion about it. Anyway, Jekatusi Michtas Shuri, the size of that, of the, its shear is considered cut down. because that asherah has to be burnt. So we consider it a halacha as if already it's burnt. Well, if it's burnt, it doesn't have the minimum size of a lulav. So therefore, you can't use it. Dekanami, the Gemara says, indeed, we can prove that from the wording of the Mishnah. Dekatani dumya di erni dachas, because the Mishnah mentioned it similar to an erni dachas. An erni dachas, we now have to be burnt to a crisp. So also, when we're talking about over here in Asherah, necessarily it has to be the kind that must be burnt, not the kind that bittul is, that not the kind that could be subject to bittul. Shmamina, that proves it. In Shulchan Aruch, it points out, I mean, practically speaking, the Goyim nowadays don't worship trees, but sometimes what they do is they plant trees in front of their getchkas and churches and whatnot. So they're actually, if they're cutting down the lulav or the hadas or whatever from the tree, that's not necessarily such an issue, because again, by cutting it down, they're obviously being mevatel it. And then in Lachatchila, it was only put up as to beautify the grounds or whatever, rather than as something that's actually worshipped. It's not a real asherah in that sense. There is actually an interesting story, and then we'll finish up. There is an interesting story in Sipur Chassidim about one of the Chassidish Rebbes in Poland, that one year they were having a hard time getting hadassim. Akitsa, one of his Chassidim, found out about a guy was friendly with a local poet, and the guy took him to a place where he has hadassim growing, and he cut some and brought them to the Rebbe. And the Rebbe said, I can't use these. They have a tzelem on them. It turned out that the hadassim grew among the poet's ancestors' gravestones, and what's on every guy's gravestone? A cross. And the Rebbe saw it. So the halacha, there wouldn't be an issue with them, but he didn't want it.
Like a monkey.